You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author whose mission is to help people achieve a deeper connection with their horses through his transformational training program.
Just because he knows that you know.
G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host, Warwick Schiller, and if you've been a regular listener for a while to these podcasts, you would have heard me at some point in time talk about a men's emotional resilience retreat that I went to last September, I think. And, you know, I've talked about how life-changing that retreat was. It was 3.5 days. And, you know, previous to that, I had done a bit of a dive into all things personal growth and trying to heal past traumas and stuff like that. You know, I did a year doing dialectical behavior therapy, both in group therapy and individual therapy. I had done some EMDR therapy. I had done some somatic experiencing therapy. I had had a doctor-induced ketamine journey to help reset my nervous system. And I also did a 3-day ayahuasca ceremony in Florida with a shaman from South America. And all of those things, I was looking for healing probably the wounded parts of me. And this 3-day emotional resilience retreat probably achieved more than all of those things put together. And it was exactly, you know, the result I got from it was exactly what I was looking for. It was everything I'd hoped for. It was absolutely amazing. So today I am very, very, very honored to have Joshua Wanner as a guest. And Joshua is the guy who invented this emotional resilience retreat training. He was the facilitator when I went. All the work was one-on-one with Joshua, and it was quite frankly life-changing, and I really feel it was so life-changing. I kind of feel that if every man on the planet could actually attend one of these things or have some of this emotional resilience training, I think the world would be a better place. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation with Joshua. I find the guy is absolutely fascinating, and I'm sure you will too. So let's get Joshua on the line. Joshua, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
Hey, I'm really grateful to be here with you, Warwick.
Hey, I'm glad to have you on here. It's good to see your face again.
Yeah, good to see you too. Yeah, really good to see you.
So I've talked on a number of the different episodes of the podcast about the profound effect that the emotional resilience retreat that I went to with you had on me. And in the introduction to the podcast, I've basically said, you know, a bit about it too. I think I'd like to start not talking about the retreat, but I'd like to start talking about you. I mean, how you obviously have found your calling in life. I remember at the retreat, one of the guys there, and I didn't say it, but I felt it, but said, you have a gift. Do you want to go over maybe some of the aspects of your life that have led you to this as much as you want to share? But, you know, I know you've got some different parts of your past that I'm sure have had a lot to do with this.
Sure. Happy to. Yeah. And I'm totally open book and totally transparent and open to go wherever we need to go. So it sounds like your question is more really focused on like what's the backstory before getting to these retreats, what led me in this direction. Is that more or less what you want to dive into? Or
yeah, like you know, you've got a military past, you've got the Tony Robbins stuff. I mean, all of the Gabor Mate stuff you've mm-hmm. got into. I mean, all that stuff fascinates me, and I'm sure my listeners would be fascinated by it too.
So I think this may be helpful. Is, you know, I'd say I start just to give a little context of who I was and the life I led, and then what kind of interrupted my path and took me on the path I'm at now. Because what I've learned from doing not only this work, but men's work is, you know, our wound, we all have wounding, and the wounding, you know, guides our direction. A lot of times it's forced direction and growth. And so my backstory was, you know, I grew up in a family, very loving, but also very like warrior based. Grew up in sports, military, very much the kind of traditional male who, you know, suppresses emotion and handles things is how I grew up. And hunting, fishing, camping, you kind of get raised around the guy's guy, if you will. And so I had a lot of deaths early on, and I tended to be the guy that there'd be a death at high school. I think we had something like 17 deaths between, you know, my high school years and early first year or two of college. And I tended to be the guy that would go there and calm everybody down and could really function efficiently, which I looked at as resiliency. And I think the turning moment for me came when my brother, I had a younger brother of 5 years who came to see me on Christmas. And he said, "Hey man, I've gotten into drugs pretty bad. I'm shooting needles. And I'm really scared that if I go back to Reno, where we're originally from, I'm going to die. Like, I need to come live with you." And at that time, I was so blinded by what I thought I would be enough if I was a successful entrepreneur. And so I'd been starting startup companies, and I had maxed out my credit cards on a startup, and we were living and working out of my house, and I had computers all over the living room. My business partner, I moved into my house, and I knew if I moved my brother in, my business was gone. He was a binge alcoholic and needed 24/7 care in addition to the drug problem. And I'd done it before, and it had ended horribly the previous two times. And so I told him no. And very surreal moment between us. He was somebody that had in the past said, "Hey, I, you know," kind of threatened suicide, and had made a comment around, "I know what I need to do." And for the first time, I felt so much pain that he had. And usually I would say, "Hey," I would plead with him not to. And I more, it was a really interesting dialogue of him, of me saying, "Yeah, I support you." And it was just weird. Like, if you don't want to be here, it's not my choice to keep you here. That's for me. And so it was almost like this last moment of our dialogue was a very surreal moment of almost like our souls talking. It didn't make any logical sense, but he was saying, "Hey, I've served my purpose, you know, mom and dad, take care of mom and dad." And it was under the guise of him being drunk and us kind of fighting, if you will. But this was the dialogue that was happening. And we ended the night. The next morning he got up to leave, and it was a moment that, like, he went to leave and I grabbed to hug him, and a part of me didn't let him go. And I just like held him for a moment, and then he turned and let go. And it was just, I remember it like clear as day. It was almost like my soul, if you will, knew, but my body didn't kind of register what was happening. And almost like I was pulling away anything, that he needed to do to go do his next role. And so, he then went back to Reno and 3 days later died of a heroin overdose. And, upon waking up to that, you know, the 28 missed calls from family, I broke down, and then I consciously pushed all that down and was like, I got to go take care of the family. And so it just shows you that mindset that I was still in, of just believing that a strong man is non-emotional and goes, handles things for his family. So I suppressed all that, flew back to Reno. I actually led the service, and I built one that everybody was laughing and, you know, actually remembering his soul in a really beautiful light. And because he was my, we were definitely, he was the closest person to me in my life. So we were deeply, deeply bonded. And then I came back, suppressed all that, and went to work, kind of put it in a nice little box, if you will, and went to go work on my company. And we built the company up to just where it was on pace to reach a million. I think we had our biggest month of 160, and then 2008 hit. And so, as you know, God sourced, the universe would have it, right as things were coming together, 2008 hit, and we go from that massive months to like 30 and then 20 and then 10. And we're just like a plane that's just circling towards you know, going to hit the ground. And so we moved the company to Arizona from California. I went to go clear my head and rethink things. And then when I came back, my business partner that I'd been living with for 2 years, I'd invested everything I had, including max in credit cards in this business we were in. And the girlfriend that I'd been living with, I came back to find that they'd turned from a friendship into a lover's experience. And so right as my business was coming to a crash, all of a sudden, in one moment, basically business partner took the woman that I was dating. So my best friend and business partner basically had committed betrayal and on the woman that I was dating. And being upset, of course, at that moment, I took off again to clear my head. And when I came back, they'd basically moved the entire company and in a weekend and took off to Mexico to elope. And so in this one moment, I'm sitting there in these ashes of, I lost my business. I had to go through bankruptcy because he took the business and I didn't have money to pay back the business. My best friend and business partner and girlfriend. And some friend gets, there's one more layer and then it shifts, you know, because it seems like, oh, you're in a pretty low place. But I then had a friend say, hey, why don't you come get your mind off things? I know you're going through a hard time. You know, come to Lake Tahoe and let's go have some fun and just have a party. It was about New Year's. And we go to New Year's and one of my buddy's girlfriend says, hey, try some of this white powder. Take your mind off things, have some fun. And I wasn't really that much into partying at that time, but I said, okay. And next thing I know, I put something in my pocket, you know, and I walk out and next thing I know, somebody's putting me in handcuffs and I'm getting arrested for a felony charge of this white substance. And so this moment came where I'm sitting in a jail cell alone and I'll never forget it. It was literally like I was so externally raw. Almost like if I was naked on the ground and people were kicking me is what it felt like. Like every area externally was ripped from me. And now this, like the worst, felt so shameful. And so like, oh man, how am I sitting in a jail cell for something that's not even my values or my nature? And that's when it really hit me, like, I chose this over my brother. And that was the journey that led me on this new journey of trying to make peace with something I couldn't fix. Like I almost felt like, you know, the person I love the most in the world had come to me for help. And I told him no to grow this other vision. And then the vision had ended so horribly. And now I was faced in these ashes of like that choice. So I think that's the point when my direction changed from my initial trajectory of like this entrepreneur to now this journey of healing. Or as you mentioned when we were talking before, the wounded healer, because that was some deep, deep wounding. And so then as a warrior, I didn't sit in that. I'm not one to sit and think. So I went and did a bunch of plant medicine. I'd worked with a bunch of shamans in different places. Some of them are really, like I had the shaman in Sedona that was like sleep on the ground and do forgiveness work. And we're going to train and run mountains and swim in the water and like very much, very strong energy, but also very nurturing and like, hey, you got to do some forgiveness work to heal this. A mixture of backgrounds, forgiveness was very, very helpful. And then I made a decision like, who's the best in the world? I'm going to go handle this and solve this. And so at the time I believed it was Tony Robbins. So out of literally my bankruptcy of handing over my car that they're taking away from me, I went right into a career with Tony Robbins where I then spent 2 years on the road helping other people transform their life. And at the time, I think I was in a lot of pain, but I just was like, hey, let me just become a student. And I would just obsessively study his content and work on integrating his content. As I was saying it every day, as I was speaking, I was also working on embodying it. And a lot of Tony's work is around peak performance, which is centrally focused on a lot of NLP or hypnosis, which the basis premise is what's the meaning you have about something and how do you find empowering meanings? How do you look for empowering meanings in life? How do you find like negative beliefs that you may have and find empowering beliefs? And then another central theme is how do you notice if you're in like a negative state and how do you put yourself into an empowering state? So I use those three things of changing my state when I didn't feel good, changing my meanings, and changing my beliefs, and just kind of led with that nonstop. And I did that for 2 years and thought, hey, I healed. I've healed my grief. I fixed it. I think I was so resistant to the idea of feeling broken. And I had bought so much into a lot of personal development is around, you're not broken. You're whole. And I was so resistant to the feeling of feeling broken that I became obsessed with feeling whole. And that's really what I did, is I took Tony's technology and I implemented and implemented until I couldn't find an ounce of brokenness in me. And I thought I'd healed my life. I rebuilt my life. Was very functional. And then I went in to try to help people around grief. And I remember the first couple clients that I went to go help, and I just failed miserably. And I mean, it was really intense, their situations of the trauma that they'd been through. One, her husband had committed suicide, to a very tragic story. And the other one was a man who had just gone through a breakup, but their symptoms were very, very similar. But I went to go help them with like, oh, I got these tools on forgiveness and I know how to change your state, and very much like taking a peak performance mindset of you're not broken, you're whole. This woman, to give you an example, she came home one day to her husband walked in the door to find one of her daughters hanging herself, and he tried to save her and couldn't, and watched her die in front of him, and was so heartbroken that he went into the garage and took a shotgun and took his life. And this all happened while she was at home and she had another daughter. So she wanted to leave too, but how could she leave when she still had another daughter to live for? So to give a context, here I'm coming in to try to sell this woman, hey, there's some forgiveness work. Hey, you can. And it was, I learned really quickly. One, I'm dealing with something I know nothing about, even though I thought I did. Two, the sense of intensity of that pain. I couldn't just wing it. I couldn't jump in. I can fumble around a lot of things and figure things out, but this required a deeper level of investigation. And feel free to stop me or interrupt or ask questions if any time, if something you want to go deeper in. But I'm getting kind of full story to how I ended up at the retreats. So then I set out to say, I need to really understand grief and loss, and I'm going to research this, and who are the experts, and let me understand grief, because I obviously don't know what I'm doing. And when I started to research, it was really interesting, is if you think about it, we're not taught to learn how to deal with grief and loss. Like there's, and yet all of us are faced with, our whole life is based on change, really. Like we grieve constantly. We grieve our age. We grieve our bodies. We grieve relationships. We grieve visions and fantasies of who we're supposed to be, our parents, our relationships, our friendships. So when I started to research grief, there's varying differences of like the experts in grief. One would say, you know, you're naturally resilient, need nothing. And then there's other researchers that say, no, you need antidepressants after 2 weeks. And so there was a very confusing, like, okay, the leading experts have totally contradictory viewpoints. So let me get in there and understand it. And so I grabbed a camera crew and I started interviewing grief and loss and trauma experts. And one of the first interviews I did, I was interviewing a guy named Ken Druck, who's one of the most loving, kind men I've ever met, and also had a level of certainty that would like, he was a kind man, blue eyes, you know, blonde hair, that had lost his daughter tragically 20 years ago, and had such a deep connection with her that upon her death, his whole family had fallen apart. And he was a doctor and a therapist and had been deeply embedded in this world. And he spent
Is he an author or something?
He is.
The name sounds familiar. Okay. Yep. I must have heard of him somewhere.
He's got some great books called The 12 Rules of Life and a lot of other ones. Okay. But he'd spent the last 20 years working with grieving families like 9/11 and Boston bombings and Sandy Hook. And he's the guy that goes in and is with families and helps them. And I'll never forget, he introduced this concept with such, you know, certainty to pierce my soul. but also with so much kindness and humility. It was like integrated knowledge. It wasn't theory. It wasn't, it was a man that had walked the path of pain for 20 years and was speaking a truth to me. And it's, as he spoke it, the words like pierced my soul. And I couldn't not see what he shared. And what he shared was, the duality of being whole and broken, meaning I'd been so attached to the feeling of wholeness, right? Resisting my brokenness, wanting to put all of it in a box and get away from it. And he introduced this concept of the feeling of brokenness is really heartbreak and the natural response to loss. Like when we love something so deeply and then it's taken from us, the reaction, the feeling is deep, deep heartbreak, which is in actuality a feeling of being broken. And it's in the ability to love and accept unconditionally our brokenness or that feeling of heartbreak just as much as our wholeness that actually allows us to feel whole again. And you know, when he said it, it put me into this whole different world of 2 years where like I was still functioning into the outside world, but I'd come home and I was all of a sudden, all the things that I thought I'd fixed and I'd healed and were there still. And it allowed me to like a window or a doorway to start to feel the heartbreaks and the breakups and deeper wounding around my brother and almost anything in there, all the way back down to like some childhood trauma of things that had been there that were areas of heartbreak and loss that I couldn't fix. And it allowed me to start to feel that. And I'll say I had no tools. I had no community. I didn't have a mentor guiding me through it. So going through it on my own, you know, I'd feel heavy and I'd be drinking a bottle of wine or eating not a piece of pizza, but a whole pizza or a tub of ice cream. And, you know, I was using some unhealthy habits. Like I had a porn addiction then and some other things to numb my pain, which I now see are just ways to numb our pain. But at the end of this 2 year period, one day I woke up and I'd been searching for years, like, oh, if I make enough money, then I'll feel better. Oh, if I sculpt my body a certain way, then I'll feel better. Oh, if I have the right partner, and only if my partner looks this way or does that thing. Or so I'd been searching externally for the thing that would make me feel a certain way. And I'd reach a financial goal and I'd feel empty. And so then I just say, well, maybe it's another goal. Or I would, so I'd been in this kind of yo-yoing hamster wheel of endlessly searching for external validation and ending up feeling empty at each and more alone at each new, I guess, pinnacle that I reached and would just set a bigger goal. And I woke up 2 years and one day I was like, wow, I feel the peace that I've been searching for all these external validations by actually doing the opposite, by learning to love and accept and just be with my pain without trying to fix it, without trying to take it away, without trying to cover it up, just loving it and being there with it. I'm actually starting to feel deeper levels of peace and freedom, I think is what I was ultimately searching for, than any of these external things. And so that was the moment that I was like, all right, there's something, there's a deep wisdom here. And how do I create a set of frameworks to walk other people through the same process that I've been going through to ultimately reach a deep level of freedom? That's the opposite area that I had been searching from. And so that's when I got busy. I hired one of my good friends, Mina, who was another speaker with Tony Robbins, who whenever I was with Tony, I'd be like swinging for the entrepreneur goals. And she'd be like, why are you doing this? Like, you're supposed to be doing your works around grief. Like, she could see it from the day. And so anybody that may be listening, I would say your purpose may already be with you or your mission or what you're made for, but you may just not want to believe it. You may be searching for something external, but it may already have been there the whole time, which it happened to be for me for a long time. So I hired her to say, you've been seeing me and challenging me to do this from the beginning. How do I work with you for the next 6 months? Let me develop a program and a curriculum and a way to guide other people through it. So that's what we did. I basically intuitively walked myself. I was the first client for myself. And I basically created a set of frameworks to walk myself deeper and deeper and deeper into any pain, trauma that was still affecting me. Almost like, what were the boxes in my life of the pain that I'd shoved in those boxes? And how did I find a really gentle, compassionate way to notice or feel what was still in me and open those boxes and learn to love and accept and feel what was still in there that hadn't been felt? And each time I did, it allowed me to go deeper and deeper and deeper until I got to the root. And when I was able to forgive myself at the root, at my root core wound, and make peace with that part of myself, and reintegrate my inner child, re-see my inner child, find my inner child, integrate that part into me and have a completion. There was this neutral event where I went completely neutral, and I could, for the first time in my life, I wasn't blinded by any stories. I could just see it clearly, like almost like a compassionate child. I could feel the whole truth and was just able to say like, oh, this is the truth. This is the truth. This is the truth. And so that became the foundation for my retreats, was the process that I'd walked through and I'd mapped out with my coach. And so then I said, okay, I got to give this. And I started my first retreat with just inviting 10 men because I didn't trust that would even work at the time. I was like, who's going to believe this? I didn't trust myself. I was like, I've spent however many years in entrepreneurship. I don't know what I'm doing in this field. Like, who? How do I know what I'm doing? I really was unsure. And so I invited 10 men to the mountains and said, hey, I'm going to create the retreat and comp it to everybody. If you guys just come and tell me, is the experience valuable? And so they came. I ran the retreat. And on the day of, let's call it the shadow work day, the day that we got into the deep work.
I recall that day.
it literally was the most, and I've been in personal development for a long, long time, but for me, at least, it was the most transformational experience that I'd been a part of watching and witnessing men release wounds and trauma and years of heavy emotional baggage and refine themselves. And I noticed just the, it's almost like they came out all shiny. They came in heavy and they came out shiny. And that's when I was like, ah, this is the work I'm supposed to caretake. This is the work I'm supposed to. Because yes, I'm creating it and putting a brand around it and things like that, but I don't believe it's mine. I believe something's flowing through me and I'm a caretaker of the wisdom, if you will. And so
you're a conduit, yeah.
I'm just a conduit for it. So that's really what led me into the work. Now I've been doing the work for 7 years leading retreats, and I started having veterans and first responders come, and that evolved into now I'm training. I just did the Air Force here and trained all 300 of the Air Force on resiliency protocol and reintegration rituals. And so it's kind of morphed into training first responders, veteran groups, starting another brand that just targets those specific industries. And so it keeps evolving. It's just like the purpose keeps evolving and evolving. And I'm just here with it and have been privileged to be in this space. And it's the only thing the last thing I'll say is it's primarily been men up to this point. The last 7 years, I've only been working with men. And now I'm learning new ways that I can create other methodologies, because a lot of the men are saying like, oh, how do I connect with my partner with this language? And how do we have a commonality? And so that's, I think, the next frontier is finding new ways to have this reach more people instead of just deep dive retreats with 7 to 9 guys. How do more people get the same tools for this? So that give you some context of the whole the whole journey. I know I talked for a while.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Now that gives me a lot of context. It's funny. I read a book a number of years ago. It's called Backbone, and it's by, I forget who it's by, but in this book he says, and I did a podcast on books that have influenced me, and this is one of the books. And in the book, he said, you know, most men spend all their life trying to get 4 things at the same time: material wealth, vocational success, love, and health. Hmm. And that's like the goal. That's like the pinnacle. If I could just get there, I'd be happy. And he says the unlucky ones get there and realize, I thought I would feel different when I got here. And they're unlucky at the time because it's a huge disappointment, but they're very lucky because it's the thing that makes you want to look a bit further. And so he, you know, because some men might get 3 of those things. If I was just healthy or if I just had, you know, a loving partner, or if I just had more money, or I've got almost everything I want, but I just want that bit more. Mm. And for the people who get those four things, it's, they're unlucky initially. But then he said, then what you figure out is there's three things you really need. Number one is you need to understand your path, your purpose. Why are you here? Number two is you have to develop a deep and authentic spiritual belief. Doesn't have to be religion, but it's a deep and authentic connection to a power bigger than you. And number three is you got to get rid of your bullshit. Hmm. And it was funny when you were talking about before about, you know, the entrepreneur thing. You're like, I got to make $1 million a year and that's going to make me happy. And then I got to a certain goal and it didn't work. Hmm. Maybe it's more. I'm going to beat my head against the wall. I'm just going to get, now it's got to be more money. The number's got to be different. That's going to make it. And I think, you know, I remember reading a quote by Jim Carrey where he said, I wish everybody could become rich and famous. Hmm. So that you could find out that it's not anything it's cracked up to be. It's not what anybody should want. But years ago, I know a guy who was a black belt in karate. I did a clinic in Scotland a few years ago, and the guy that organized the clinic was a black belt in karate when he was quite young. And he said, I thought when I got to be a black belt in karate that I'd kind of know everything. But he said, then I wanted to be a second dan black belt in karate, and I thought I was going to learn all this new stuff. And I didn't learn anything new. I went back to the very beginning and learned everything I'd ever learned with a black belt's eyes.
Mm.
And you cannot learn it with a black belt's eyes the first time. You've got to learn it as much with the amount of understanding you can learn it with. Mm. And then when you get to be a black belt, you go, okay, now we're not going to add anything to it. Now that you can see things a certain way, we're going to go back and we're going to relearn the whole thing from the beginning. And it's almost like that when you get to that point to where you realize the things you thought were important aren't important, then you get to go back and start again. And it sounds like that's what your journey was. And I also wanted to say, I recently had a guest on the podcast, and the guy's name is Rupert Isaacson, and he had an autistic son took his son to Mongolia to visit some shamans there and made a movie about it called The Horse Boy. That was an independent film. And then he wrote a book about it called The Horse Boy, and also wrote a book about their subsequent journeys to see shamans, which was called The Long Ride Home, maybe. And then he went and visited shamans in the Bushmen of the Kalahari, and he went and visited Aboriginal healers in Australia. And he visited Navajo healers in Arizona. And he was saying in that when I was talking to him, that most of the shamans all have something that has affected them in certain ways. And quite a few of them are on the autism scales. Quite a few of them are bipolar, schizophrenic, that sort of thing. And that's actually a gift that helps that stuff. And from the books I've read about shamanism, I've read that, but I've also read, or they've had near-death experiences, or just you know, unbelievable amounts of bad things happen, whether it's grief or whatever. And it sounds like that's where part of yours came from, you know, because you have a gift. There's, you know, there was something going on at that retreat. That is not, you know, NLP based, or not, you know, it's not quantifiable. There was some stuff going on in that room on the shadow work day that can only come from somewhere else. And I think, you know, reading about shamans and stuff, you've got to have some wounds to be able to tap into that something else.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been very deeply, I think since two things. One, I was born with my umbilical cord wrapped around my neck. That's how I came out, like kind of purple and blue. And some of the more recent therapy that I've been doing, that's one of the things we're starting to dive into, of like, oh, what's the trauma from that? Because in my work with Gabor Mate, which I'm in his compassion and inquiry, which was a 12-month course with him. He says that 4 weeks after embryo is when our implicit memories start. Implicit are memories that you can't remember. Explicit are memories that you can. And so literally 4 weeks after embryo, which is like the first amount of you starting, and that's before we have words or language or sounds. And so the trauma's there. And so I think that definitely was an indicator. And then when I just had a lot of death, I was around a lot of it. I mean, I had multiple suicides. I had a good friend that I went and helped clean up the suicide incident. So I was just very closely connected to that world of death and grief. And I think after my brother, it definitely forced me to really go deep. I mean, I went deep into the channelers and psychics, and I went deep into that whole world of like, if he's still here, I want to communicate with him. So is it real or not? And if it's not, then let me move through it. And if it is, I'm going to find it. It was kind of how my mindset was. And I talked to so many different psychics and channels, and some of them are full of it. But there was some very legitimate, specifically this one of my friends now, really dear friend of mine, her name is Sunny Dawn Johnson. And, I mean, she finds missing people for the FBI. So it's not a fake thing. It's total legitimate. And the things that she would connect and fill in the gaps for, nobody would know but my brother and I. And that's, I think, what provided me peace and my family peace. And to tie in your point, I think that's what allowed me to start to build my own connection with, call it the other side, call it source, and then start to listen to that side. And I'd say really that's my, even the whole retreat, and this is what was the hardest part. My background with Tony's whole blueprint is modeling, what he calls modeling, where if you want to learn something, go learn who's already doing it and study the 2 millimeters. Like if I were to understand with you and horses, if I spent a week with you, watching you, asking you very specific questions, I could probably learn the mastery level pieces. It might even be what you teach in your courses of like, what are the couple mastery level things? Cause you've been doing it for so long. So modeling you, I could learn those pieces. And so when I went to go create this retreat, I would have traditionally went to go, let me research all the trauma and grief experts. And when I was meditating, call it my connection with whatever created us, let's just put it that way, I got a very clear, no research. it was like trust and have faith that you already have within you the blueprint. And that's, I think, why it was so hard. I think so many people say, once you find what you're made for, it gets easy. And in my opinion, that's total BS. I've had the hardest 7 years of my life, most fulfilling without a question of a doubt, most on purpose, most peaceful as my nature, my spirit, my soul, but stepping into that unknown of full faith of like, oh, something's streaming through me and I only know the next step and I'm designing this next step. And so trusting that and then seeing and even doubting myself. I remember before my coach, that first retreat, the process, which is now the shadow work process that you're just describing, which is my core gift in implementing in that process. I remember going to my coach saying like, I need to bring in somebody else to do like a fire walk, or I need to do something. Cause I didn't believe in that process. It seemed too simple. Like it wasn't effective and it wouldn't work, you know? So it's like you think of, and okay. Then she,
oh, go think ahead. About yeah. The one that there was one thing that came up for everybody at the retreat that you taught. I am enough. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard thing for us all to wrap our head around. And it sounds like you were having a hard time wrapping your head around. Like, I'm not enough. I need a firewalker. I need, you know, I need somebody with a bit of pizzazz because I don't have the pizzazz. Yeah.
And so I think the reason in sharing that is twofold. One, to also full circle that shaman energy. I think really good shamans are just following something, trusting greater whatever created us and allowing that to flow through us. And it takes a lot of faith. And then two, stepping into that to trust it. When you start to follow that faith, it's very intimidating because if we start to focus on me, which is what you're talking, the I'm not enough, it can get overwhelming. And I remember she said, she yelled at me. I mean, she was like, she's like, this is it okay to swear in here for a moment? Or is that, yeah, I don't know. What
you, knock yourself
she,
out.
So she was like, hey, this is fucking bullshit. She's like, if you were just in a box speaking just with you, it wouldn't matter. The key is about you. And I'm that's why I'm so grateful I hired her. I needed somebody to allow me to step into that. And then the irony was, that's the foundation of the entire work. So it just is like, you know, it's amazing how it all unwraps and it keeps evolving. That's what's interesting is every time I'm in the space, for some reason I learn, I intuitively know how to do more. So something is still, something else is creating it. I'm just trusting and listening and surrendering to learning more. If I'm like, I'm somehow intuitively learning more things and I don't even know what it is. Like I couldn't even describe. I'm now learning to explain what I'm doing from like deeply researched science and therapeutic studies. Like I can now start to go like, oh, I see why it's effective, but I've been doing this for 6 years and I had no clue what I was doing, but something greater was flowing through me. So it's interesting how it works, right?
Yeah. I'm a little the same with the horses. Like the science comes to me second. You know, in the last few years, I've really been working on like attunement with horses, like the sense of being seen and being heard sort of thing. And I didn't know what it was at the time. And then polyvagal theory pops up on my radar. I'm like, oh, that explains scientifically why what I'm now doing works so well. So it sounds like you're coming from the back end too. Let's talk a little bit about, did you want to say something?
The only thing I was going to say is, and also I know equestrian therapy is really helpful even on the amygdala. Amygdalas regulate. It's a part of our fight or flight response. And so both the polyvagal and, you know, that fight or flight regulation, horses are so powerful for helping to regulate the nervous system and combining those two. So just, I love the work you're doing. I think it's so healing for people to work with horses. It's so healing for them. And the horses know, you can't BS a horse. Like they respond to your nervous system. Oh, yeah. So
it started out horse training and it's turned into something a bit more than that. Let's make a jump into the retreat if we can.
Sure.
You know, the first night we all get there in the afternoon, we have dinner and then we go in the living room in front of that big fireplace and you're like, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to go around the room. You're going to tell us your name. You're going to tell us something that rhymes with your name just so we can remember your name. And then you're going to tell us something, some deep, dark secret you've always had that you've never told anybody, ever. And it's like, whoa, I'm sitting there thinking, whoa, that's a hell of a way to start out the whole thing. But it was a, and then you went and you said, I'll go first. And you dove right in and like, wow. But that was the start of the whole cracking us open, you know, because you cracked all of our eggs that weekend. But that's the start of that authenticity, like letting who you are on a soul level sort of thing out instead of having that shield up there. And so that was the first night we did that, didn't we? And you did a couple of rounds. Like once we went around once, you're like, okay, let's go again.
Yeah. Now that you've gone, let's go a little deeper. Who wants to go a little deeper?
Yeah. And I don't think we all went again, but it's, there's something, and I've talked about it when I talked about the retreat on the podcast. There is something about sharing your deepest, darkest, shameful things as a man with other men. Like all my therapists have been women. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but there seems to be something different about sharing it not only with another man or men, but the therapist. When you spill your guts to the therapist, they don't spill their guts back to you. There's no quid pro quo sort of thing, whereas this thing, you spill your guts out and then someone else is equally vulnerable and then the next guy's equally vulnerable and it you just, the content that comes out really gives you the whole, oh, me too, like, you know, you think you're the only one who's ever felt these deep, dark, shameful things. And I think that's a big part of it, is we all think that there's stuff I couldn't tell anybody else because they wouldn't understand and they would judge me poorly. When you finally do that, you're not judged poorly. You have another guy go, yeah, me too. And you're like, what? You know, and that was the first night. So that was That was a great start to that. Has that been a part of all the retreats since the beginning?
Yeah, I think, I mean, each time I've evolved it and it continues to evolve, but I started the first one intuitively like that. And now I've just learned to frame it and go a little bit deeper with guys and learn to be, but it's two things. One, leaders always go first is the way I look at it. And leaders lead with vulnerability. And then two, it really depends on the context. And then this container, very specifically, it's safe. So I think there's a distinction. Just going around sharing in a non-safe container doesn't always lead to the same outcome. Right. Because in normal society, many times people do have shields and they're, you know, they got armor and they're not in the same space, but we all came there to heal and for the same reasons. And then the container that was specifically created had confidentiality. We knew it felt safe to go there. And part of it was about going deep. And I find it sets the tone. So it's like when we set the tone and we go there right off the bat, you notice guys come in the beginning and it feels really tense. The nervous system's tense. Nobody knows each other. Bunch of new guys know they're coming to do some deep work. Everybody has their idea of what it's supposed to be. And you can almost feel the intensity in the room, almost like you could cut with a knife the intensity. And I find after that first night, it drops the whole energy. Guys, what we're doing is we're going from head to heart. And the head is the one that, you know, has all the stories, as you were mentioning, the stories and what do other people think of me? And I'm the head is trying to protect us we are built for survival. Our human nervous systems and brains are highly intelligent. And since we're children, they adapt for survival. So the primary wiring is survival based. And so, and it's trying to create safety. That's the key. So if we have an environment that is safe and we have an environment that we have control, which are the two things I'm constantly creating, is giving each man safety and control and they're choosing it. That's when we have, and it's the same thing applies in relationship. Same thing applies with ourselves. If we can get safety and control, then our adaptations to it, which are typically our body trying to maintain that, we can start to consciously choose versus reactionary choosing. So that's how the retreat starts, so that we all get on the same page quick. And I lead them by throwing all my stuff out to say, hey, it's safe. It's safe to go here. And two, here's how far I'm willing to go. And then second, I find when guys go around, the culture in the group starts to become what's uncomfortable and how do I share what's uncomfortable? And then I'm sharing for me, not because of how I may be judged with other men in the group. And when I do share, there's another layer I'm able to access that was this layer was protecting me from. And so I think that's what does it. Kicks off the night. Guys all of a sudden drop in. They come a little bit down, maybe to their nose. If they start off in the top of their head, they're now in their nose going like, oh, I'm feeling a little bit safer. And over the course of the weekend, it's a buildup to that shadow work where we're all the way into the hearts. And then that rips us anywhere open to go all the way down.
Yeah, so that was Thursday evening. Friday we start out, and you really, and I've talked about this before, you really get into the whole king, warrior, lover, magician archetype. Mm-hmm. And that, I thought that was absolutely, absolutely fascinating. I've talked about it before in the podcast, but do you want to maybe go in quickly into the four archetypes?
Sure. Yeah. So there's four. And they originated from Jungian psychology, but essentially there's four primary archetypes. And Robert Moore there's a book called King, Lover, Warrior, Magician that's evolved them even more. And then I've adapted them with my business partner, Philip Folsom, in our whole K4, which is a men's group. And we've adapted them even more. But essentially there's four primary archetypes. One is the king. And each of these archetypes represent our journey when it's looked at the context of men, but it can work for women as well, of our journey from what we call prince, which is boy psychology, to king, which we refer to as mature masculine psychology or integrated man. So prince to king, boy to man. And so each of these archetypes represent a different aspect and the qualities and aspects and the shadows of those archetypes that we can step into, or a diagnostic system to identify when we're in boy psychology or adolescent behavior and how to step back into king or man behavior. And so each of them represent a different piece. So for example, the king's energy is all about creativity and inspiration and hope and how we express ourselves in the world. And so we like to use the king and make it relevant for career. Who are you in your career? How do you show up in your career? And the king has some, what we call trauma signs. Is the king, if it's in its adolescent behavior, is focused on the self, and its mature behaviors focus on service. So it's going from self to service is the transition of the king. And when the king's focused on self, usually it's tied to inadequacy. And when the boy, let's call it prince, feels inadequate, it can look like the tyrant, which is a power play. I don't feel powerful, or I feel inadequate, so I'm going to be tyrantly to you. I'm going to take my power out and make you feel less powerful. Or the weakling, and the weakling would be somebody that basically gets walked on, has no power. So that blueprint says, oh, if I'm acting like a tyrant, it's an action signal that I'm in a survival mechanism of my boy psychology, and the map shows me, oh, I need to step into service to move through it. So that's kind of the blueprint, and each of them have a similar one. So the magician is focused on our craft. Think of it as plans, processes, procedures. It's really the alchemizer. Think of it as like Merlin built the Excalibur for King Arthur, right? Is like in story. And so the way we look at our magician is, what is the book that you want to give to the world? What's your legacy or your craft? It could also be your spiritual practice. What is your spiritual process, or what's the execution? Think of the magician archetype as the executor. From the king sets the vision, the magician makes it happen and executes it. And the two guiding pieces are fear. Magicians tend to be very logic-based, non-emotional, and they can let fear bug them. And the way that we move through it is through faith. Faith is stepping in. So for me, that shaman archetype was me stepping into my magician to have faith instead of the fear of letting it stop me, choosing faith to move through it. And the shadows, when we don't manage our fear, or we're in adolescent psychology, is the passive-aggressive energy.
Yep.
Or it's somebody who loses logic to destroy somebody. So those are those two. And then we go up to the lover. The lover is the primary work that we're doing in the retreats. And the lover is all about experiencing life and all the different values that it has. It takes a series of events and ties them into a living, breathing experience. So think of the lover as presence. The lover is connection. The lover is relationships. The lover is joy and passion and excitement and aliveness and fulfillment. And it's also grief and sadness and sorrow and some of the heaviest emotions that we feel. So in the archetype of the lover, when we're an adolescent, there's grief and grace. So the grief is really, when we don't manage our grief, it shadows out into the addictions. So all of addictions, whether it be drugs or alcohol or porn or video games or whatever that looks like, work or depression.
Right.
And how we move through it is, again, grace. We feel our emotions. And then the last one is the warrior. The warrior is about decisive action, healthy boundaries. Think of the warrior as questing, and it goes and makes things happen. And with the warrior, one of the challenges with the warrior is if we are in boy psychology, then we can let anger affect us. And if we don't manage our anger, the anger can show up as the sadist or the masochist. The sadist is somebody that makes other people suffer, and the masochist is somebody who suffers themselves. They punish themselves. And so the way we move through anger is through action. We take action. We set boundaries. We take decisive action. So those are, we talk about in the retreat, because we're primarily looking at what are the trauma signs that we're noticing. And instead of feeling shame for what we're doing as a trauma sign, we recognize like, oh, they're just adolescent behavior. They were my boy psychology of how I survived childhood. And I never had a map or a rite of passage to teach me what it meant like to become a mature man. So the archetypes give us a model or a map to understand like, oh, who do I need to be in this moment? In my business, I may need to be the warrior, and I may need to go handle stuff to go make some money, or the magician. But when I come home, I might need to put on my lover, and I might be present and intimate with my spouse or my kids or my family, and different archetypes for different situations. So it's really the master map of who do I need to flex into to become a man in full for the situation? And it's never it's not the strongest that survive. It's those that are the most adaptable. So that's what it gives us, is how do we adapt, and a blueprint to do it.
Yeah, I love the shadow parts of it. You know, like the, you know, say for the lover, it's either depression or it's addiction. And so it kind of gives you a bit of a roadmap to, whereas if you're experiencing something, rather you go, oh, okay, I'm in the shadow of this part. And I almost had a bit of an existential crisis at that retreat when you first started talking about the whole, you know, the king does things for the good of everyone, and the prince does it for external validation. And here I am, I'm a public figure, you might say. You know, I've got close to 23 million views on my YouTube channel. You know, that I've got in the social media sphere, I've got some decent numbers, you know. And I really started thinking when you talked about that, I'm thinking, what has led me to get those numbers? Has it been, I think I've been doing it for the good of others, because, you know, like my YouTube channel just started out trying to show people how simple some things can be with your horses. But as it's grown, then I'm thinking, oh, am I doing it for the external validation? Because there is a lot of external validation that comes with that. And I'm like, am I doing it for the right reason, for the wrong reason? So it kind of helps guide me these days. Like if I think I want to produce some content, write something, write a blog, write an article, I want to make a video, put it out there, I kind of stop and think, why do I want to put it out there? What's, you know, is this about me, or is this about helping people? And it kind of guides me as it, usually, I don't usually find that I don't make the content, but it might cause me to adapt how I was going to do the content, because, yeah, for the most part, this is King Energy, but there's a bit of Prince sneaking in there, and he's a sneaky little bastard. I mean, you don't know until you know about that Prince Energy, you don't know about the Prince Energy, but he's, yeah, there's a lot of, and especially, you know, if you grew up in the era of children should be seen and not heard, and there wasn't that much, you know, probably as much validation as you needed, so there wasn't as much achievement as you needed. It's a need, and it's a powerful bit of a drug. So I really draw on that stuff every day with what I do. And so that day, that was cool. Was that the day we went for a walk that afternoon?
Yeah, we went for a hike that afternoon in the evening.
Yeah, so we go for a hike, and at the start of the hike, Joshua has us pick up a rock. Find a rock. We're in the desert of Southern California, up in the mountains, but it's deserty. And what did you say? Find a rock, and what was this?
That represents the grief you've been carrying.
Mm. And find a rock that the shape of the rock denote something, yeah. And then so we all hike in silence for probably half an hour or so, wasn't it? And so it was really interesting carrying this rock. And I picked up, some people picked up smaller ones. I picked up one that kind of had some sharp edges. And I think it was also kind of heavy too. So I couldn't forget I was kind of carrying it. And it was, there was something cathartic about that, walking with a group of men carrying your grief rock in silence. I don't know, you're brilliant, the things that you do, because it wasn't just carrying a rock with some blokes. Mm-hmm. There was something that happened, something that transpired with all of us on that hike. And then, so what did we do at the end of the hike?
And then we share what comes up for us. What did it represent, and what do you want to do with it?
And most of us pelted that rock to kingdom come.
Well, I think that there's a powerful metaphor, is we don't, again, especially in male psychology, we're so prone to disassociate from our anything messy, any pain, anything we could be perceived as weakness. So we're so used to warrioring up with our shield and our armor that there's just not a lot of time to be with our grief and it to be okay. And so that's the primary focus of the weekend, is how do we just be with this part of us? And so that's what the hike represents, is we spent the last day and a half starting to do some digging and feeling, which is, I'll say, by the way, one of the things I say on the first day is, most men say, I don't even know what you mean by feeling. Like I said, hey, we're going to start to feel. They're like, I don't even know what you mean. I don't know what you mean by feeling. And so part of that practice is spending a lot of time feeling. And so that exercise gives us a chance to go, huh, now that I've been doing some digging into my boxes of grief and I'm starting to know how it's affecting me, let me just walk and be with this for a while and notice, how has this affected me? How have I been carrying this? Is it a dense weight? Is it a light weight? Is it a sharp, jagged, you know, what is that? What is my association or relationship with my pain, with my grief, with what's still in me? And then what do I want to do with it? And you're right. Some guys chuck it. Some guys set it down. Mm. Right. So they change the relationship with it. So it's interesting. Each guy gets a chance to say, what do I want to do with it? Which is powerful. And it can be very emotional, which is interesting. To your point, you think carrying a rock, but when you have the safety to be with your emotion, and it's not looked at as weakness, but actually strength and power to feel. There's something that happens where guys are naturally more open. And that's a big part of what happens, is some guys get emotional, noticing what they're feeling. And that's the primary function, is just allow that to move. I look at a lot of time, like things happen and they get stuck. And so how do we create the space just to get them to move, get things to move within us? So.
Yeah, I know, you know, when it came to the point where I had to tell everybody what that rock represented, you know, I got pretty emotional and it started to move some stuff within me. And then we got to watch a beautiful sunset, and then we got lost in the dark on the way.
It's always fun.
It was fun. So the next day was the day we did the shadow work. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit on what that was?
Yeah, so it's kind of hard to explain, but
it is.
but one way to try to give some context is, think of if we've just spent essentially like, you know, a day and a half starting to know, like, I almost kind of look at it like if there's a bunch of like solid ice, imagine we've been kind of picking at it and like kind of breaking it all up, but it's still there. And so we've kind of broken a lot of stuff up. We're now much more aware of things that have been with us, and things start to link. So when you start to reflect on your life, you start to notice some core patterns. A lot of men come in a lot of times going like, I know something's not working, but I don't really know what it is. And I give a metaphor a lot of times. Imagine if you're in the Sahara Desert and you're looking in all directions and all you see is sand. Like, where do you start? But imagine if you reached down and there was a wire, you could follow the wire. And that's what we're doing over those first couple of days, is noticing like, and the wire is by feeling. We're starting to notice what's still in me. What am I still having a reaction to? Oh, wow. And let me keep going into that uncomfortability of what's uncomfortable. And the more we do it, it leads us to the root of our origin, or the root trauma, the root wound. And so on Saturday, part of that practice is a place for us just to be seen and acknowledge what comes up. And then two, there's a hands-on portion where essentially there's a belief that the body already knows what it needs to do to heal. And so a lot of times when we carry grief, unconsciously the body's overcompensating to try to protect us. So one man may stand up and we might say, hey, where do you feel pressure? And he might say, hey, I feel pressure on my stomach. And then we say, hey, can we put some pressure on your stomach? Another man will put pressure until he doesn't feel the pressure anymore. And then we do that same activity to say, okay, now where did it go? And the mother might say, hey, I feel it in my shoulders. And it feels like I got a heavy weight on. We might say, hey, do you mind if we put a guy on each side of you and you don't have to put that weight on? And we start removing the weight more and more and more until the man doesn't feel it. It feels neutral. And once we get to that neutral place, it just releases. There's the body naturally can release anger, it can release sadness, it can release grief. And then there's another process, because we've gotten so close sharing, where I'm asking guys if they need to have any completion conversations. And there's some completion that comes with, and it just, I'd say it's more of like almost like a unconscious state that guys go into, where they're almost in an unconscious place where they There's another thing I've learned from Gabor called internal family systems, where we have this child, we have this adolescent protector, survival self, and we have an adult. And a lot of men will move from the adult self and they'll go back to the survival self and the child self. And so that's really what we're doing, is we're integrating those pieces. But the way we do it is we ask who, if they're okay, if we bring certain people in, and then they have completion conversations with certain people, and any emotion that's there gets released. So men may have sadness, they may have anger, they may have whatever's in the body, but because we've created so much safety and control, again, safety, control, and they feel safe in their body and their nervous system, and all the men in the room are holding the space for each man, they feel safe enough for the body just to do what it does. And it's almost like I imagine as a participant, you're not trying to do anything, and more or less it's just happening, and you're observing or witnessing yourself walk through the process. And I'd be curious to see your experience of it, but that's from a facilitation standpoint, that's what we're doing, is we're creating safety, letting the man, each man do his guide his own journey. And then as we bring up certain people, they have completion. And then when it's neutral, they may need to do some forgiveness as well. And then we fill it back in. Once they're neutral, which is exactly the thing that I did first, once we do that same neutral process, then they fill it back in once they can feel the truth. And that's when we're kind of creating space for them to release emotionally whatever's in there, neutralize it, do some forgiveness, clean up, and then fill it back in with what they feel their truth is. And I'm curious to hear your experience as a participant.
Yeah, well, that whole, you know, when you ask, you know, the somatic part of it where you've got your hands on us, you know, when you ask, you know, like say family members to come into the room, like, can you bring them in? Do you have anything to say to them? Whoa, I was surprised at what I had to say to a few people. Mm. And I think everybody really had some stern words for most family members. Mm-hmm. But once you work through that, mm-hmm. anything else you want to tell them? Yes, I love you. It all came down to just complete love once you got all the shit sorted. And it didn't matter if they hadn't spoken to this family. I mean, I get along with my family fine, but it didn't matter if someone hadn't spoken to their family member for 30 years. Once they got rid of all the shit, there was just love. And that was very cool. And I got to tell you guys listening, so this was a pretty intense thing. So you sit in a chair in the middle of the room and you say whatever you want to say, and Josh is right there with you. And if you feel any tension in your body, Josh will put his hands on that part of your body. And usually that goes for about 45 minutes. And then, you know, and you've spilled your guts by this point in time, and you're pretty raw before it starts, so you're ready to spill your guts. But then this whole somatic thing goes on, and the whole time Joshua is right there, like he's present and with you. And he said, you know, you want everybody else in the room to be present with you too, not on their phones or fiddling around or whatever, like they're pretty present too. We started this at 11 o'clock in the morning. Did one before lunch, then we broke for lunch, and then we went through the rest of the guys, and we finished up at 3 o'clock the next morning. And it was a marathon effort. But can you imagine holding space for someone for 15 hours? I mean, I don't know, it must just completely drain you. I don't know if it drains you or it electrifies you, But you know, when I do clinics, and I'll be standing in the arena and I'll be talking for 10 hours a day, and I'm present right there with each horse and person and working through stuff, I'm never tired. I don't get jet lag. I don't get thirsty. I don't get hungry or whatever. I'm just there. But after a 2-day clinic, I'm just wiped. You must be wiped.
Yeah, during it, same thing. I think I'm running on service. Mm-hmm. Like if there's coal in my fire in thy engine,
yeah.
What's getting shoveled in is service, mm-hmm. energy. And I mean, I could just keep going. I've actually had to be more present on a couple of retreats to pause and go to the next day, because I could keep going, but I checked the room and have had to work a little bit on that piece of it, because if I'm not as present with them, I think everybody's where I'm at. And but then the week after, I'm usually shot for about a week. I'm still functional, but I'm just really tired. And I've, so I think it's interesting you brought up shaman earlier. I've been talking to different shamans and using certain strategies on how to cleanse my energy a lot more. Mm-hmm. And the more I'm learning to allow things to move through me, the faster I'm able to recover. And so I'm getting much better at that piece of it. It's definitely a, but I gotta say, it's like, there's something so, I could never put even I couldn't even describe it in words. It's so profound of being able to be in that type of transformational space and witness, men reintegrate themselves. And it's such a, the irony is I don't have a lot of memory. So it's I don't know if it's something that I'm, you know, doing something from whatever created us is what my intuitive nature tells me is that for whatever reason, I'm so present in the moment and know every detail and every word. But for some reason, when it's over, I don't remember anything. So who knows? Maybe I'm in like an altered myself. I'm in an altered channeled state, or maybe if I was processing all of it, I couldn't keep doing it. But for whatever reason, guys usually remember their experience really well. And if they remind me, I can sometimes catch glimpses, but I couldn't go through and tell you the details after. But in the moment, I'm so present with all the details. So it's an interesting, from a facilitation standpoint, it's a really interesting thing of like being able to be so present in the moment and yet later have no, and maybe that's it. Maybe I'm not processing it. I'm so present. I'm not in me.
Right.
Might be part of that. So it's real time mm-hmm. with them, not me, which may be why I don't take it on.
Right. Yeah. And that somatic part of it. I mean, there were some of the participants in there. I thought they were having an exorcism, you know, yeah, it was just that whole day was really profound, and the energy in the air in that house the next morning, like we all got together, like we were different men than we were the night before. It was it was absolutely profound.
It feels to me like a very true rite of passage. It is a rite of passage experience where you go through when I've researched what the definition of rite of passage is, it feels more like a spiritual emotional rite of passage. That's the work men are doing. I mean, even if you look at it comes very similar to like anybody that's done plant medicine that may be listening to this. It's almost like an ayahuasca ceremony without the ayahuasca. Essentially, we're going through a process to internally go in and feel all the different things we may not want to look at. And then the purging is like a purge, but it's a purging of whatever emotional debris has been with us, but we're doing it present without any substance, without anything to do it. Just the space and the container and the men naturally guides us there. So, but it's a very similar process without the ayahuasca of an ayahuasca experience.
I thought so too. I mean, I've had an ayahuasca experience, and I actually got out of the retreat what I thought I wanted from the ayahuasca experience. And you know, they say Mother Ayahuasca gives you the experience you need at the time and you're ready for it mm-hmm. at the time. So obviously I wasn't ready for that. And I think the ayahuasca may have, you know, been a part of the journey. But I coming home from there, driving home from there, I'm like, that's what I thought I was going to get out of the ayahuasca. I thought I was mm-hmm. going to shed some shit, you know, and I shared some stuff there, so it was absolutely amazing. Why don't you tell us what you're up to now and how people can you know, because before I went to that retreat, I really had no idea about men's work. You know this all falls under the umbrella of men's work, and I didn't realize it was a whole sphere of work that's going on. So why don't you tell us all about what you're up to, what you're, how they can maybe get involved in something like this? And I want to hear about your movie. I know you've got it all filmed. I don't know if you've got it all edited, but there's a movie that I'd really like to know what you're going to do with and where people can find out about that.
Yeah. So, they can reach me directly, just joshuawenner.com, and it's JOSHUAWENNER. And on there, there's all the projects I'm involved in. One of them is this brand is called Emotional Resilience Training, or ERT. And I've taken this time during COVID to pause my retreats, and I'm about to release a digital version of this. So people can get releasing the Emotional Resilience Training and the Emotional Resilience Toolbox. So the training is the same frameworks that I actually teach in the retreat, including the archetypes, and just reframing our concepts on loss, grief, and trauma. And then the toolbox are emotional regulation strategies. So one of the things I've developed is a protocol called CPR. And it's for us to identify when you were talking about prince to king, really another way to say it is when we're in survival mode, how do we move into thriving mode? And there's science-backed ways of certain breath work. And so I've created a whole toolbox of regulation breath works, emotional regulation breath works that you can do solo, you can do with the partner. And I'll even see if I can have one that you can give to your listeners to just check it out with and sample with, or a link to it. And so that's really cool. So I'm going to have the ERT digital product. I'm also going to do a version for couples that want to practice. I think the Gottman Institute says couples that regulate together stay together. Mm-hmm. So it's if you can understand your partner's wounds and your wounds and be really loving and gentle with each other, and instead of fighting, you actually end up building more intimacy and you learn to regulate together, and it changes the whole game, and can also help with anxiety and stress and depression and all these different things. So so there's emotional resilience training, and I'm releasing the digital product, which I'll put down. I'm also will be starting my retreats up again. I'm thinking we're getting better with numbers, so probably last quarter of this year, I'll probably do another retreat. And then I run another organization called K4. K4 is a men's group, and it's an online men's community focused on helping men that are driven by growth and service become men in full. And K4 stands for King of the Four Houses, which we're really about mastering the archetypes. And we have a 13-week rite of passage process where men go from the same kind of deep diving that Prince to King psychology, and they learn the three master maps, which are the archetypes, the hero's journey, and the tribe triangle. I also teach some of my emotion and resilience training. And then they have just a community of men that are supporting them to become men in full. And the focus there is how do we continually grow our business and our career? How do we continue to make our family, our relationships really solid? How do we improve our body and our health? And how do we give our gifts or leave our legacy with the world in a spiritual practice? And so that's K4, and that's just k4men.com. Every quarter we open another cohort of men. So April 1st will be the next one. And then after that, July 1st will be the next one. So there's K4. And then the last thing is Valor. Valor is my organization, Valor Resiliency, and that's dedicated to helping first responders, veterans, and actually doing training. I just booked another sheriff's department, and we do a lot of fire departments. And so if anybody's in first responder communities, veteran communities, that's the program for that. And then the film, it's really exciting. I've been filming for the last 6 years. And the film's called Grief to Grace. So you can go to grieftograce.com, or again, this is all on my website, Joshua Wenner, if you want to learn a little bit more. But I've literally documented my whole journey. So I documented my whole journey, starting with being on grief forums, not knowing how to help people, all the way through 30-something interviews of grief, loss, and trauma experts. I've filmed my retreat. So if one of people want to see what the retreats are like, I've literally documented my whole process from not knowing anything, the story of how my family's dealt with grief and loss from my brother, all the way through now with the work that I'm doing with training first responder groups and fire departments and police departments, as well as my family's full transition from going from how they've dealt with my brother's loss of not changing his room to their healing. So it's a really beautiful journey. That's kind of a mixture of a really powerful, uplifting story that's true, combined with 30 different interviews from different leading experts in the fields of grief and trauma, including Ken, the man that I mentioned earlier.
So, Ken Druck.
Ken Druck, yeah. Amazing man.
Wow, I'm looking forward to it. So, when I came back from that retreat, I said to several people that if every man on the planet got to do this type of work, the planet would be a different place. And so any of you men listening, I really urge you to take a look at this stuff. It's not weird. It's not woo-woo. It's actually the ultimate in badassery, I think. But Joshua, you have a gift, and you are definitely changing the world. And thank you for the work that you do. And thank you for joining us here on the podcast. It's been a blast catching up with you again.
Thanks, Warwick. Super fun. Really, really appreciate you, brother, and love you, and grateful to have you in my life as a brother and as a friend. And thank you for having me on and sharing this with your audience.
Hey, I love you too. And yeah, thank you for changing my life.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 650 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.